I believe when you take a gene from a different species or kingdom and insert it into another to get the beneficial, quote unquote, result, that you have to test it as a food additive, because we really don't know what the effects may be, particularly as concerns people's allergies and how people digest the food. My favorite example is BT potatoes, which have actually kind of died in the marketplace for their own, for other reasons, not for labeling reasons. But a BT potato has something called BT, which, as an organic farmer, has been used for decades. It's a bacteria that naturally kills insects in their larval stage by destroying their gut. And we use it as a foliar spray at a certain time in the plant's lifetime when they get attacked by different types of worms. When it's engineered, BT is in every single cell of that plant for the life of the plant. And when you eat, for instance, a BT potato, it's in every single cell of that plant. Now, BT originated as a, from, comes originally from a soil bacterium that, and the BT killed other bacteria in the soil. It was just serendipitous that we found out that it killed larval. It's actually, its evolutionary place in the world is to kill other soil bacteria. So my question has always been, if you have a diet of BT potatoes, what is that going to do to your gut? Because that BT toxin will kill bacteria still. And we know that BT corn, which is very popular, though it's not in sweet corn, we don't eat it, but cows eat it. BT corn has it in every single cell, and when it dies, the root system is playing havoc on the soil bacteria. It is killing soil bacteria and changing the whole soil fauna, which is so complicated. Scientists are just, it's like looking at the ocean, how soil actually reacts to interplays. It's really amazing ecology. And what we're doing is we're taking like millions of acres of corn and killing vast amounts of bacteria with this BT additive. So I think that's another part of what I'm calling for, is having studies for the ecological effects of the environmental effects. Like, what is BT doing to the soil? And the thing that's horrendous, another aspect that's horrendous about this genetically engineered food is that as a farmer, the birth rate of a farmer has been to save seeds, any seed. And it's been the agricultural commons. That's what we've been doing for thousands of years. All the varieties of food that you see in your store are the result of millions of farmers over thousands of years sharing seeds. And now, in the last 10 years, the biggest chemical companies have bought all the big seed companies. And they put up patent protections. And the courts have ruled with the corporations that what they're doing with seeds is so unique now, they have the right to say no one can take this seed and grow it without our permission. So what's happening is we're closing the agricultural commons that was about crop progress, making farmers sign contracts that they can't save seeds from these crops. This is all at opposite to the stream, intellectual stream that created the bounty. It is closing down the ability to share seeds. And if you talk to academics now involved in genetic engineering that are actually for it, they're tearing their hair out about how hard it is for them to progress now, because they have to go, they spend way more time doing paperwork to get permission to use genetically engineered varieties than they actually have time studying what they're doing. The paperwork is outrageous. So lastly, let me tell you, if there was ever a symbol of a government, of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations, the courts and the government have ruled that genetic engineering food is so different that they have the right to patent it for the first time in history. But it's not different enough that you have to test it for food safety. That's pretty bad.
do now criticize the conventional strategies of foisting off odious installations such as prisons and garbage dumps on rural communities in the name of economic development.
You know, we have heard from the right now for 20 years that the only fair tax is a flat tax. Well, we have a flat tax in this country. It's called the Social Security tax. It's a flat tax on all income below $84,600. If you're an employee, it's combined with your Medicare share, it's 7.65% flat tax on your income. If you are self-employed, it's a 15.3% flat tax on your income as long as it's below $84,600. However, the majority of Americans in all the Social Security debate we've had are unaware that the Social Security tax is not applied to any income over $84,600, nothing. So consequently, Bill Gates, the richest man in the world, pays the same Social Security tax as his employee of Microsoft because he's the president of the board and he's the employee. You know, it doesn't matter. So the richer you are, the smaller the tax burden is. It's not a flat tax on you because you stop paying any portion of your income after $84,600. And a self-employed farmer making $42,000 pays the same Social Security tax as Bill Gates. And this is nuts. Completely nuts. And what's more outrageous is that most Americans don't know the Social Security tax is only a flat tax on low and middle income people. In fact, it's a social insecurity tax because it's taxing many poor people directly into poverty. You just can't afford to pay 7.65% of your income if you're only making $20,000 a year. That runs up to $1,500. You know, you can't even hardly make ends meet if you have a family with that kind of money. If you're self-employed, take a self-employed farm worker, okay? Now, most people don't realize that farm workers, market workers, are always self-employed because the farmer isn't going to, pay their share for the Social Security tax. They're freelance. And, of course, they're going to deduct the cost of their labor, and so they're going to 1099 them. They're going to get a 1099 freelance. So someone, self-employed farm worker that ekes out $10,000, is supposed to shove out $1,500 to the government at the end of the year? I think that's not likely to happen. It pushes people into what's called the black market economy. They're afraid to relate to the government because they don't have the money. If you make 20 grand, your husband and wife make 20 grand, and you're self-employed, you're going to shell out $3,000 to the feds? I don't think so. Or if you do, you're really going to be strapped. I mean, it's just so much pressure on people. In my estimation, you can hardly make ends meet in this country if you're comfortable unless you make more than you have to make at least $30,000. I think that's where we're at in this nation. Consequently, my idea for Social Security is that we have a standard deduction of $15,000 for an individual and $30,000 for a couple and $5,000 for each dependent. And so that if you're a married couple making $30,000, you don't got to pay the Social Security tax because you have the standard deduction. We have in this country something called earned income tax credit, which is a saving grace for low-income people right now. If they have two kids and make $20,000, then they don't have to pay Social Security tax. The federal government pays their share of the Social Security tax for them. If they happen to make $30,000, though, they completely lose all their earned income tax credit, and they have to fork out, if they're employed with a corporation, about $2,000, and if they're self-employed, about $4,000. So I'm saying we need a standard deduction to keep people from being taxed into poverty, and the way to pay for it is to lift the cap on income. And I don't just mean earned income. I mean, but you know, if you make $1 million, then you're going to pay, you're going to get your standard deduction, just like everybody else, and then pay, if you're an employee making $15 million, then you're going to pay a 7.65 flat tax on your $1 million income. One reason that the Republicans went nuts at Bill Clinton in 1993 for his huge tax increase was he lifted the cap on Medicare. The cap on Medicare no longer exists. It doesn't matter how much money you make and earned income, you're paying the nearly 3% in Medicare is coming out of your paycheck. And that's the way it should be for Social Security too. Now, I've got a more radical. I think that we should apply the Social Security tax as a flat tax to unearned income as well. And that means rent, dividend, and interest income. Because there's something wildly wrong about having a building, for instance, owned by a landlord where everybody's paying Social Security, but the landlord who collects all the rent doesn't pay into Social Security at all because it's unearned income. People that make money, unearned income, whether it's interest or dividend or capital gains or rent, they are dependent on the welfare of human beings as are the human beings, the laborers themselves. And we should apply the Social Security tax to their income as well. One hook I put into that is that we would have two different standard deductions. In other words, you could make 30 grand with a standard deduction for your earned income and a standard deduction for your unearned income. You could separate them. So if somebody's got a rental house and making $10,000 on the side, I'm not saying you're going to get blasted there. I'm saying two different standard deductions so that you can take care of your retirement. But the idea that you make $1 million of capital gains or interest or dividends and you don't pay anything to the Social Security system when it's going bankrupt, that's crazy. Let's just apply the Social Security tax to all income and create a standard deduction of 15 grand for an individual and 30,000 for a married couple.
What about the credit card interest and the recent new laws on bankruptcy? You had quite a lot to say about that in your position papers.
Just another example of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. It is now total madness, the credit card industry. One of the benchmark rates for determining interest in the country is something called the bank discount rate, which is the amount of money that the Federal Reserve loans money to its biggest commercial customers. It's currently 1.25%. And it was 5 and 5.5% through the 90s. It's down to 1.25%. Now these same banks turn around getting 1.25% interest rates from the Fed, and they're charging their many people 16, 21, and 24% interest rates. But this is we're in the thousands of percent profit on this Federal Reserve money, guaranteed money. This is unbelievable that the Federal Reserve can loan money to the commercial banks at 1.25% and they can turn around and charge 24% to low and middle income people. That's nuts. It's usury. It's something that's been decried in the Bible. Every culture hates people that gouge people. And this is the gouging of the century. They also are doing things where if you miss two payments, even by a day, if you have a low interest, if you miss two payments in 6 months, if you have a low interest rate, they triple your interest rate. I have a couple of credit cards that are at 7% right now, so they've gone down with the, but I have these contracts that if I'm late by one day, twice, in 6 months, I'm at 21%. And it's never coming back down until I switch. It's crazy. It's completely crazy. And yet, in all this madness of banking, is it a surprise that the credit card industry is the most profitable part of banking? In all this madness, with the economy tanking, in my opinion, going to go very near a depression when the interest rates go up and because of this federal deficit we're starting to run, when we go, our economy is tanking. People are suffering. And what does Congress do in the face of more bankruptcies? It's passed both houses, now it's in conference to get it settled. We are going to make bankruptcy harder for small people. Why? Because the credit card companies don't like it when people declare bankruptcy and their credit card debts are thrown out. That's what's gone down. So in the face of this looming depression, we have a Congress that is bent, and this has all been pushed by the credit card companies, to make bankruptcy harder so that they get every single dime that those people that went too far on their credit cards owe them. And the reason they went too far on their credit cards isn't because they're not honest people, but that they were being gouged at 16 and 24%. So I've said limit the credit card interest rate to 11%. One reason that Sherwood Bowler is 326 in Congress for bringing money into the community is because into his district, Oneida County, home of Utica and Rome and Oneida, and the jobs have been leaving because it's got profitable for these to be, you know, the industrial jobs and going to other countries. So, and he's been pushing, pushing that this big business as usual, NAFTA and gas. And he always has pit photo ops with these big giant checks that take two people to hole, that he gives to communities. But in fact, it doesn't total up to, he's like in the bottom, he's almost the bottom fourth of in Congress for bringing money in, because real money comes from big federal contracts to corporations. And corporations in this part of the world are leaving. And it's not for lack of skilled labor. That's for sure. My platform has been about the self-employed. Let's first deal with who's staying. Who's staying? It's the people that are in the community because they live in the community, work in the community, and they have type of job that they don't need to go to another country. They're not even in their ball field that they go to go in another country to get a cheaper labor source. If they move, it'll be because they can't find employment, but it won't be because they want to pay 13 cents an hour to their employees. So who are those people? Those are the self-employed, like the farmers and you know, the carpenters and the machinists and computer programmers and doctors and independent practice. They're self-employed. We should first talk about what problems they have and make working for them easier, which is right now when regulations are written for corporations, they're applied to individuals as if they have the same means to comply with the. And if you cut the self-employment tax in half, which is the first thing I want to do, and also, and if we manage to get a Social Security standard deduction through so that the self-employed people wouldn't have to hide from the government, because so many of them are relating to this tax bill that they can't pay, and thank God at least that they have the earned income tax credit, which is their saving grace for many of them. If the self-employed were actually able to do business in a way that they could be open, that would be hugely important to helping rural economies like the 24-city and local urban economies too, that they wouldn't have to be afraid of the government because there would be nothing to be afraid of the government for. You know, we have a lot of criticism about the quote-unquote cash economy. Well, a lot of the cash economy is about people not being able to pay outrageous tax bills. Okay, if people could participate in the economy without being taxed into poverty, which is really the struggle that the self-employed are having, then that would really be a big burst for this economy, both in creating jobs and letting the self-employed keep their money so they can invest in themselves and their business. That would grow the economy. And then I told you, I really think the key to our security and our war with Al-Qaeda is not bombing Iraq, but in going forth with alternative energy and putting up the solar panels on the roofs of our home, which are already wired, and something called net metering, which means that when you generate more electricity than your home is using, it goes out in the grid and your meter literally runs backwards. And right now, with the current cost of electricity in New York State, a home in Binghamton creates, with, you know, four modest-sized solar panels, $800 worth of electricity a year. We have, it's not just Southern California. There's plenty of light falling on this part of the world. Those windmills in Madison County, each one of them produces 1.65 megawatts of electricity. The seven of them together are producing enough electricity for 10,000 homes. What a burst to this part of the country if we could start investing in alternative energy. And as I said, installing solar panels, that's great work for self-employed people. Great work. You know, you don't need corporations or governments to do that. And corporations need to build these solar panels, and they need to build the windmills, and the government could capitalize it. I mean, this is what we need to gain security in our world, and not to mention side benefit, a healthier planet that makes us proud to be citizens. And then the one other crop, as a farmer, the crop, and it's also New York Farm Bureau's official position, industrial hemp should be grown everywhere because it used to be the backbone of the rural economy in colonial days, and it should be the backbone again because there are thousands of products that, for people that don't know, hemp, industrial hemp is the same species as marijuana, which is cannabis sativa, except that it doesn't have the THC in it to get you high. In other words, you could smoke a bushel of it and you would only get a very bad headache. It makes fabulous clothing. Hemp is the strongest plant fiber in the world. It grows like crazy here and all over the country. It serves the same purpose as wood pulp. Whatever you can do with wood pulp, you can do with the pulp of hemp. So it has diverse uses as building materials or as clothing. So New York Farm Bureau wants to legalize it because it's got such a long history in this country. For instance, the Bill of Rights was drafted on industrial hemp. The Constitution was drafted on industrial hemp. The Declaration of Independence was drafted on industrial hemp. It's a great paper product. It's a great wood product. It's a great building materials product. Fabulous oil for cosmetics and health benefits. The most important thing you need to grow industrial hemp is water. We have water in this part of the world. Industrial hemp should come back for farmers. We should be rotating with corn. It's a fabulous crop to rotate with our other ones. It's an amazing weed killer. Nothing can outgrow industrial hemp. If you want a weed-free soil, you can grow industrial hemp, and then the next year will be weed-free because there's nothing that's growing under hemp. The last thing I want to say about industrial hemp is that the future of rural America in this part of the world does not belong in casino gambling or garbage dumps or prisons. That is no future. It belongs in sustenance. And industrial hemp is about sustenance, about clothing, about textiles, about building and energy, wind farms, and that's about energy. And it's about sustenance. And I believe that just right there, there's a two units of production that we rural people can really handle, and we have around us the sun, the air, and fertility and water to make those part of our economy explode. And the only thing that's holding us back is capital. And this is where private markets have failed. Because if people are telling us the only way to grow your economy is through prisons and garbage and gambling, that is the meaning of that is private capital is failing your people because we have so many needs that are bigger than that. So a big part of my platform is when private markets fail to meet the needs of the American people, then the people should use their own capital to grow the markets. Well, this is the situation. We need to capitalize with our own money, industrial hemp, and alternative energy. That's the bottom line.
What about the laws that bar the use of industrial hemp? It sounds obviously like a very sensible solution to many problems. Who's opposing it, and what are their grounds for doing it, and how would you overcome that if you were elected to Congress?
It's a federal law. And actually, industrial hemp has not been banned by the feds. The law, and if you read the books about industrial hemp, there are actually provisions to keep using industrial hemp because it has such a long history in this country. You know, like take the USS Constitution, that famous boat. Each was rigged with 60 tons of hemp. 60 tons, imagine, in rope and canvas. Because the word canvas comes from the word cannabis. That's how long hemp has been around. And World War II, there was hemp for victory. We started, hemp production started right up again. After it had been closed down for several years, we needed it for ropes, we needed it for parachutes, we needed it, and it came right up. And in the and when they redid the marijuana laws, changed them around from the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act and modernized them, they still made provision for industrial hemp. However, the DEA has decided that industrial hemp is the same as marijuana, and is treating it exactly the same, even though the original statute clearly differentiated the two. So, A, first of all, if I was in Congress, I would sponsor a bill that says industrial hemp is legal. B, I think there is a way to fight this on a regulatory level that they've usurped the power of the original statute. So there's two directions. C, I think medical marijuana should be legal. And so I don't think that we should have that problem of separate, you know, because I think the key to getting industrial hemp legal is to make medical marijuana legal. I think there are a lot more people who are in tune with the need for medical marijuana than are with the need for industrial hemp, and that these two groups should combine together and come up with it, to realize that they need each other. That's the politics of it. A lot of the city people want medical marijuana legalized a lot more than they even could dream about what industrial hemp would do. But those two groups need to come together so there isn't such a complete vilification in this country of marijuana, quote, unquote. People should become aware that Canada has now legalized medical marijuana all across the country of Canada. And industrial hemp is legal in every single industrialized nation that we deal with. Canada, the European Union, Russia, China, Japan, Australia, all of them. And in the last 10 years, it's grown to be a $500 million market from $5 million. It's exploding. We need to legalize medical marijuana and industrial hemp, and we've got the climate to just jump into the industrial hemp world. There won't be a lot of money in medical marijuana, but taking the stigma off of it would really make things a lot easier. And as long as we're on the marijuana topic, let me simply say that I believe that we should relate to marijuana on the federal level, because this is a federal job I'm running for, the same way we dealt with alcohol. It was a disaster making alcohol illegal. It's a disaster making marijuana illegal. 500,000 people a year are arrested. What a waste of money. 500,000 people are arrested a year on marijuana. We should do just what we do with alcohol, which is repeal the prohibition and leave it to the state to regulate how recreational marijuana. Leave it to the state. The feds should get out of it. As soon as the feds get out of it, we'll have legal medical marijuana and we'll have industrial hemp, because marijuana is already legal in many states. And some states have legalized industrial hemp, but they can't go forward because the feds keep fighting. Right now, 40% of the women and half the men in this nation will develop cancer in their lifetime. To me, that's an astounding number. And it's the terror that we all live with. Every 2 days, as many people die of cancer as died in the World Trade Center. And I wish we had the public outrage and the public motivation and the public outcry against cancer that we have against the World Trade Center. Because everything that the screaming and crying about the World Trade Center is justified, it's just as justified about cancer. But our leaders and our public is not letting us focus on this issue. And what we have in this country is a plague called cancer. According to the World Health Organization, our rate of cancer is 4 times higher than what a natural background would be, because cancer is a natural occurring condition. It's not a natural occurring plague. And we have a plague in this country called cancer, and our national policy is about cures, but it should be a national policy about causes. And I believe a lot of the causes are due to environmental factors. And what we need is a national cancer registry, which would be a voluntary questionnaire given to people with cancer, asking them where they worked, where they lived, what they've been exposed to, their living habits, and it's a voluntary questionnaire. If you don't want it to fill it out, you don't fill it out. But if you do want to fill it out, if you want to like attack the monster that has attacked you, has attacked your family, will attack your children, then you have the ability and the means now to fill out this questionnaire, and we can look for the epidemiological history of this disease in this nation and start doing the statistical analysis that we have the computers to use to run and find out what are these exposures. Because we have a mobile country, and while we have state cancer registries, which do not only ask to only identify the cancer and where it was, it doesn't ask any questions about the environment and who you were. Where we die is seldom where we were born. So these state registries do nothing to deal with the fact of the environmental causes. So we need to get a handle on this beast, because it's the terror that we all live with, and it's the terror that I've already had in my lifetime. I don't know anybody who doesn't have a friend or a family member. I don't know a single person that doesn't have a friend or family member that died of cancer. And I think that when you're a child, when you're a baby and then a child and then an adult, a lot of life is about focus. And as you get older, you become aware of what society has done to focus you and how you yourself have learned to focus. And propaganda and a propaganda machine and a media machine is about focus, making you focus. All right, so now we got this war in Iraq, and we're focusing. We stopped focusing about corporate corruption. We stopped focusing about the economy. We're focusing on war. Where did this focus start? It didn't start with me. It started with somebody else. Well, I hope the focus moves to cancer, because we need to focus on this problem. But that focus threatens a lot of people's property rights and a lot of corporate institutions that are probably, in fact, responsible for cancers.
The erosion of privacy is an issue Dunow has addressed in his platform as well. Prime examples are marijuana laws and marijuana law enforcement, which he says have, for tens of millions of Americans, been a lesson in tyranny that has eviscerated respect for government and engendered only fear.
I think that this is one that I share with a lot of conservatives, because I really believe that that what you do in the privacy of your own home is nobody's business but your own, period. Absolutely, period. And I believe the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution protects that right. And what the Ninth Amendment is, which I can't remember the exact words offhand, but it basically states that because we didn't name this right in this Bill of Rights, no future government should be tell you that you in fact don't have that right. We have listed these rights as absolutely being protected, but because we forgot one, don't think you don't have it. And I believe right to privacy is completely in the Bill of Rights. It didn't use the word privacy, but it's all over the Fourth Amendment, and not having to testify against yourself or search and seizures. And the way to address the right to privacy is what you do in the privacy of your own home is nobody's business but your own, as long as you don't hurt another human being. That's it. And so consequently, I really think one of the horrors of the last 30 years has been drug testing to get a job. I think it's so outrageous that you have to urinate in a bottle to get a job. I think it is such an invasion of privacy. I know that many people who have never done drugs in their lives and never will not urinate in a bottle to get a job. They think that is the most invasive thing that you could do, and it's an outrage to even make you go through the process. My act that I want to sponsor, which would end the prohibition of the federal prohibition of marijuana in this country and leave it to the states to decide what to do with recreational marijuana, would absolutely ban the testing of of people's blood and urine for marijuana to get a job. I think it's just wrong.
At the core of Dunal's vision is an environmentally sustainable economy.
Your soil, fauna, your life cycling, the cycling of nutrients, the whole gamut. These are services that are provided by nature for free. And if we destroy nature, we're actually destroying the bloodline that makes it possible to do business in any sustainable fashion. So, for instance, take water. And what people are actually very unaware of is that when you measure gross domestic product, illness and cancer and pollution all grow the product. They all grow the product. That is considered creating wealth. But in point of fact, I do not know a single person that believes that driving to the store for bottled water is an improvement in his life over getting clean water out of his tap. And the fact that more and more people are buying bottled water and raising the gross domestic product is not a reflection of a healthy ecosystem. It's a reflection of a really sick ecosystem. There are lots of things that you just don't need. But if you live in a polluted place where the only water and your groundwater is foul, you got to get in your car to get the water to drink, it grows the domestic product, but it doesn't. It's not a drive you want to make. It's a drive I never want to make. It's one of the reasons I live on this farm is that I knew we had water and that I had a big enough piece of land that I could never going to have to drive to get bottled water because it comes right out of the tap. And I think that's a really important luxury for people to realize in the 24th Congressional District that we have some really, really, really amazing assets that many people in the world can only dream of.
Let me ask you something. Speaking of those assets of water that we have here, free trade is the Americas agreement. One of the things that they're trying to do is promote the privatization of water. How would you protect us? How would you protect our water?
Well, I don't.
If you were elected to Congress.
I think actually some of the people in the Great Lakes will have some real problems with the privatization of water as a threat to actually their ecosystem. I don't know if they'll go after the Finger Lakes or this area for like grabbing the water because it's hard to take water is heavy. There's not a good thoroughfare to take the water. The Erie Canal isn't big enough to like take the water from Lake Cayuga to Ontario. But I think what is important for people that's going on is that the local waterworks are being bought out by private companies and across the country, not only in third world countries, but in the United States, there are many local waterworks that were publicly owned, they're being privately bought for profit, and they're not working as well. And I think that water is as important as it gets. It's one of those things you die very quickly if you don't have. And I support keeping most waterworks in our municipalities are publicly run, and I hope they stay that way. I don't think it's going to get better from privatization. Really need to be aware of who your neighbors are and what's going on if you want to keep your aquifer clean. Long Island used to have some of the best water in the world, and there was one year, I can't remember the name of the chemical, but potato pesticide that was used that has destroyed half the aquifer in Long Island, and it was only used for 2 years, and it's gone.
You've been listening to an interview with Mark Dunow, Green Party candidate for the 24th Congressional District. For more information on Mark Dunow's campaign, you can visit his website at www.ruralparty.com. That's ruralparty.com. The producers of this program would like to extend an invitation to Mr. Dunow's opponents to be interviewed on their positions on the issues. You can contact us on email. You can contact us by email at unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, A-L-L, dot net.
Tonight I want to take a few minutes to discuss a grave threat to peace. It arises directly from within my administration and its drive toward an arsenal of terror. The instruments of mass death and destruction. We have every reason to assume the worst. We have billions of dollars in illegal oil revenues to fund more weapons purchases, allow terrorists access to new weapons and new resources, and make blackmail a criminal feature. We will act with the full power of the United States military to use biological, chemical, or a nuclear weapon. The United States would betray the purpose of its founding and resign itself to a future of fear. That is the America I know. That is the America I serve, to live in fear.
The Ontario County Green Party is sponsoring a peace march and rally on Monday, October 14th, tomorrow, in Geneva, for voters who want to express their opposition to Bush's Iraq war and also find out more about the Green Party's candidates. The march will assemble around 9:30 a.m. at the northern end of the municipal parking lot facing Smith Opera House. From there, the march participants will walk 1 mile through the Geneva Business District and out to the city's lakefront gazebo on Route 5 and 20. A rally sponsored by the Ontario Greens will begin at the gazebo at noon and feature many of the candidates as well as entertainment. And while we're on the subject of upcoming events, a Latino Heritage Month celebration concert will take place on Friday, October 19th, at 7 o'clock p.m. at the Community School of Music and Arts in Ithaca, located at 330 East State Street. The Finger Lakes Strings with pianist Claire Halpert will be performing music and songs by Latin American and Spanish composers. The concert is free. For more information, call the Latino Civic Association of Tompkins County at area code 607-277-8699. That's 607-277-8699. Also worthy of note is the anti-Iraq war resolution passed by the student government of Ithaca College on October 8th. The resolution was drafted by members of the Student Government Association with the help of other concerned students. Students for a Just Peace and the Ithaca College Young Democratic Socialists were two campus organizations that helped with this effort. The resolution passed by a 3-1 margin.
I've heard in beautiful cities, far off in the land of the blessed, but in the only cities that I've ever known, we get no rest. I've heard in beautiful mansions, far up in the azure sky, but the only mansion I've ever known were not you or I. I have heard a beautiful story, and at times but a ghost. are often by and by. But the only banquet that I've ever had was a piece of moldy
I'd like to conclude the program by taking a moment to address some listener comments we've received following last week's broadcast of a speech by Dr. Michael Parenti. WEOS got a couple of calls from listeners angered by the speech. I didn't speak to the callers myself, so I'm responding based on what was reported to me. What was most interesting was one caller's demand that views such as Dr. Parenti's not be broadcast, on the grounds that they were anti-American, a censorious position many would consider anti-American in itself. Michael Parenti is American, as is G.W. Bush, as is the angry caller, as am I. The argument that a position is or isn't anti-American is pretty meaningless to me, but if being American has any value to me, it means that I have the ability to advocate for and struggle to achieve the type of society to which I can consent. I don't consent to being governed by this present system. I am forced to submit to this government by a network of coercion that threatens my life and liberty. I think calls such as the station received support the substance of Dr. Parenti's analysis, that there are two concurrent threads in American culture that are mutually antagonistic. One is that of popular struggle to expand democracy in order to distribute the blessings of liberty and prosperity to widening circles among the people. The other is that of totalitarian empire, based on taking from others through force in an ongoing orgy of violence and greed, and constricting liberty only to those who have prosperity. This latter current is exemplified by the present so-called leadership of this nation. Though it has been a perpetual feature of the government, which has always followed John Jay's dictum, that those who own the country ought to run it. I invite those objecting to Dr. Parenti's analysis of American political history to submit evidence demonstrating any false statements or errors in his speech. I will be happy to present them here, unlike the corporate media and NPR propaganda machines that won't give dissenting views a fair hearing. The station manager of WEOS told me he explained to callers that the station airs a variety of perspectives. One caller suggested that the station be more selective in the variety of perspectives it airs. I'd like to assure listeners that the producers of this program, which is the only group I can speak for, are indeed selective. While we're not in absolute agreement with every voice we present, we only present material we think contains ideas worth the attention of our listeners. In the case of Dr. Parenti, I would like to categorically state that I am in full agreement with his analysis and condemnation of American empire, the failure of capitalism, and its fundamental incompatibility with democracy. As I said in the introduction last week, I believe we are at a time of particular crisis in America. George W. Bush has repeatedly referred to a variety of other countries as part of an axis of evil. I know that many people are uncomfortable using the term evil when discussing political issues, as it seems too supernatural, but I have no problem with the term. To me, it seems a fitting description of people who would blithely kill, maim, and immiserate unlimited numbers of other people in order to gain wealth, power, or prestige. And this description of evil fits the Bush administration and the people behind him who have planned the policies now being carried out in my name and with my money, as much as it fits Saddam Hussein, the Taliban, or any other tyrants. But because I am an American, G.W. Bush and his friends have made me an unwilling accomplice in their murderous greed. And if a variety of other nations have evil leaders, a great deal of responsibility for that rests with the American empire, which has fostered and foisted brutal dictators on many unfortunate people all over this world, including Iraq and Afghanistan. The people of those nations, most of them fundamentally decent folk, such as we ourselves are, have been made to suffer twice. First under their brutal leaders, then under horrific bombs dropped in my name and built with my taxes. The issue for me is not whether something is or isn't anti-American. My concern is with presenting ideas and analysis that will assist in creating the sort of society that I want to live in, which at the present time exists nowhere on this earth. Very frequently, the people who become enraged by criticism of the U.S. government, particularly when it comes to the war-making of that government, tell critics such as myself that we should either love it or leave it. Those of us who feel the way I feel, and we are many, though our voices are seldom heard, have just as much right to be here as anyone else. Let me therefore make a modest proposal to the war-loving fans of empire. Let us divide the U.S. in half, and let us each have our own country. You can keep the system you so prize that will have you working 40 hours a week or more at a meaningless job you hate, for the privilege of filling your gas-guzzling car with fuel to drive through a landscape littered with Walmarts and McDonald's where fields of flowers once grew. You may fight and die to your heart's content for the privilege of living for the weekend and paying out chunks of that hard-earned paycheck to a government so that it can build weapons and employ armies and cops to make sure that you don't kick up a fuss should your masters deem you superfluous and uncompetitive. So that you won't come against them with the outrage they deserve, but will resign yourself quietly to a bed in the doorway of a dirty street, where your fellow proud citizens will drive their shiny new cars by your prostrate body as if you were just another hunk of garbage. If that's the country you want, be my guest. In our America, no one will work 40 hours a week unless they want to, because they so love the work they do, or a matter of life and death demands attention. The jobs that are too stupid, boring, or dangerous for people, we will build machines to do, because technology will serve us rather than compete with us. We'll all enjoy the leisure that this gives us to pursue activities that we do like. We probably won't have too many overnight delivery services in our country, because the phrase, time is money, will never be spoken. In our America, we'll understand that time is priceless, as it reflects the minutes of our precious lives, lives which each of us deserves to have filled with love, beauty, and a sense of dignity. We won't have too many fast food restaurants, because we won't have to be in such a rush to conform to someone else's regimentation of the hours of our lives in order to be more efficient tools to produce profit for them. We will sit down to delicious meals, free of poisons, and take as long as we like to savor them in the company of loved ones. We won't fear cold or darkness because the power of the sun and the wind will light our way, and no one will have to pay, kill, or go without. It will be an entitlement of citizenship. We'll have many doctors, engineers, craftspeople, and artists. No one will be stopped from pursuing an education for lack of money or feel compelled to study something they don't like just to be able to get a job after graduation. We probably won't have too many stockbrokers, bankers, prison guards, or cops. We won't need them. We will give to all our citizens with open hands, and what we will receive in return is the pleasure of living in a community of capable and self-respecting neighbors on whom we can rely. We won't compete with each other, at least not about anything more serious than a sports match or a pie-baking contest. We'll cooperate, and thus not waste time in the production of useless items that are all the same anyway. We will spend lots of time making decisions about how we want things to go in our country, and will take as long as necessary for everyone who wants to speak to be heard from and participate. Those among us who lead in various things will be those we most admire, instead of those who are the most vicious, corrupt, or adept at kowtowing to the powerful. We won't pledge allegiance to a flag, under or not under God. We will have noted that mandatory words are usually an indication of the falsity of the statement. It won't be necessary to indoctrinate small children into believing that they live in a country with liberty and justice for all. It will be obvious in their daily lives. Our America will still have unpleasant tasks. There will always be garbage and plugged toilets. But we will divide these chores equally. And because no one of us is stuck spending all their time doing them, we'll do them with as much good cheer as we can. We won't have much of an army because we won't go around the world stealing from others and making enemies. Probably our greatest threat will come from your America that will consider our country to be setting a bad example and encouraging insubordination against the wealthy rulers of your country. They have done this so many times before. Our worst problem will be how to make room for all the immigrants that will flock to our open borders. You, caller, might even be one of them.
You still catch me napping. One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. My guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.